The views expressed in our episode are ours alone and do not represent any other organizations. Our episodes discuss internet crimes against children and cases that involve the exploitation of children and may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do. We don't want to scare anybody.
Hello, everybody. This is Tony Godwin with Catfish Cops. It has been a few minutes since we did an episode. Things at work got tremendously crazy and busy, and we're right here before the Christmas holidays. But Brandon is not with us today. He is a little under the weather, so wishing him a quick recovery from whatever's going on. And so today, we have a special guest, Amber Lee. Amber Lee is someone I met recently. I don't know, what was it, maybe a month or two, month and a half ago, something like that. I got an opportunity to come out to Utah to attend a, I don't know what you call it, like a wellness retreat, kind of a get your headspace right, that kind of a thing. And it was amazing. One, the location where this was held was utterly amazing, like utterly amazing. I can't even begin to describe it. And I won't. But at that retreat, there was a lot of professionals and a lot of advocates that came forward and spoke to us about things in the whole arena of child exploitation and human trafficking. And at that point, I met Amber Lee, and I like hit her up immediately. I was like, hey, would you please want to come on our podcast? You know, you don't have to. You don't want to guilt trip you or anything. But she's like, yeah, cool. Why not? And so joining us today is Amber Lee. How are you, Amber?
I'm great. I'm super happy to be here. I love what you're doing. This whole podcast, I've listened to several episodes, and it's informative, and I think it's important.
Well, good. I appreciate it. I hope you made it through the first three. We kind of sucked at this in the very beginning, but we're kind of in the groove now. We've been able to overcome some hurdles and whatnot, but I'm super appreciative of your time. So I don't want to steal any of your thunder. I'm going to let you sort of, you know, steer the ship as we go today. I think our listeners are going to benefit tremendously from what you have to say and the perspective you have that you have as a survivor. So give me a little background. Tell me what's going on.
Sure. So I grew up in Utah. I was rescued from human trafficking in 2016 by local law enforcement, and was in that situation for several years. I think as I explore this whole process, I think I was a limping gazelle. I was an easy target, and that was due to a previous history of abuse in my life. Previous, you know, sexual assaults, physical assaults, domestic violence, and addiction issues. So immediately, I believe it made me a candidate that would comply in these situations. The grooming process started in 2010, and I would say about 9 months later is when the trafficking started. I did not realize I was in that situation until a hospital stay in 2011. But I couldn't find any way out and remained in that situation until 2016.
So just for reference, you were an adult when this began?
I was an adult.
Not? Okay. Mm-hmm.
No, I was mid-20s.
Okay.
People ask me all the time why I didn't just leave. And I would say the psychological chains were far more powerful than physical chains.
Right.
I had been outcasted from my family, my community. Everyone likely believed that it was severe addiction issues and a really devastating domestic violence situation. So there were, you know, threats to my family and loved ones. So in my mind, it was simply just giving up and just waiting for the end, but trying to keep my family safe because there was a lot of violence that
right.
came along with this situation. And then there became a situation where I was a bit of a renegade, and that was me giving up. I was not complying very well.
Right.
At this time I was on felony probation. I had taken a charge for a dealer. I was the one who got the charge, and I had a female probation officer, and she was an excellent probation officer, but she had an understanding of violence and abuse and my affiliations. And she knew that some of these affiliations that I was around were very, this gang was extremely dangerous.
Right.
And one day she had created a safe space for me to say something. And in that moment, it felt like my life was going to be over, but I didn't really care. I was done. I had given up. So by saying something, I thought it was going to be the end for me. And that was, in a way, kind of comforting. But it did lead to some criminal charges, and then the hard stuff started. So being re-recruited back in by different gang members, my story had made the news, and they had said my trafficker's name. So by proxy, they knew it was me.
Right.
So being re-recruited back in, it was extremely difficult. There was no safe place for me. And at that time, I had learned that incarceration was really safe for me. I could sleep, I could eat, I could read, I could shower, I could call my family. Incarceration was the safest place. And I knew that it was comforting to be there. And at the time, we weren't even using the right verbiage. Even my story in the news, they called me a prostitute, even though, I mean, clearly reading it, you can see that there was extreme violence, coercion, and I wasn't really left with a choice. So I had made a decision to go to jail, commit a crime, go to jail. Law enforcement was so great with me. They were so great. My probation officer was great with me. They were trying to be so patient with me, but even access to aftercare and resources, everything was very limited back then. We're just trailblazing this whole thing right now. And the complexity of a survivor from, you know, ongoing trafficking for several years, we're talking long-term care.
Right.
Health insurance and, you know, private insurance doesn't cut it. So I was kind of left to my own undoing, and drugs was a reprieve for me. It was the only way for me to escape myself and what was happening. So I commit this crime and I go to jail, and I'm safe. I'm gaining weight. I'm seeing like a doctor, like if I have any issues, like things are going really well. And then based upon those charges I had, I wasn't eligible for any type of release, because at this point I'd known the system and I knew how to go and how to stay.
Right.
But I had gotten a visit from the prosecuting attorney on my case for the trafficking. And at that time, both myself and my trafficker were in the same jail. I were to go to court, it would be likely that, you know, we might see each other in passing in transport. So he had came and they had made a way for me to get out of jail.
The prosecutor did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. On an ankle monitor and attend trial and try to be supported in that. So I thought about it and I did. I got out, and my family at this point was starting to realize what was going on.
Right.
And so I had some family support. So 2 days before, you know, the trial, a couple of days before the trial was supposed to start, I had agreed to this ankle monitor stipulation with the jail and gotten out and tried to prepare myself for what was coming. And that was that preliminary hearing where I needed to go through everything that had happened, all the charges. He had, you know, several felony one charges and just probably 25 different charges.
Wow.
And I go, and it is the most terrifying experience. Sober, you know, seeing him across the room in maximum security, shackled, he's disheveled, like it's just terrifying. And I'm there for hours. I didn't have a victim advocate in what we would describe today there that could, you know, turn things on, turn things off, slow things down a little bit. And I just barreled through it, you know, and I got a lot of great feedback from the prosecutors, like, you know, you did really well. We're going to be able to go forward with this. But I left that courthouse and immediately sought drugs. And my intention was to kill myself. Wow. One day I intended an overdose and it didn't work. You know, I woke up and I was still left with what was going on in my head.
Well, I can imagine that the trauma alone of having to go through that whole process and face the person who has traumatized and victimized you for such an extended period of time. Like, you know, from our side, the law enforcement side, like, you know, it's ingrained in us as we go through these things and we're exposed to all of the things that we're exposed to, and prosecutors as well, because they have to see the same sort of evidence. And so again, and I know there's been leaps and bounds since you've gone through this, but you know, to think of how things were back then, like you said, you didn't have a victim advocate. That's, to me, in today's terms, that just blows my mind that wasn't on the radar, you know, for you. So, man, how brave of you to be able to do that. And you know, listen, nobody's judging anybody for anything. You know, like you reach back out to those comfort things that, you know, whatever your intentions were or however they were. I mean, I think anybody would understand that when leaving that kind of a situation, leaving that courthouse after all of that trauma just getting dumped back on you would lead you to do those kind of things.
Yeah, it was so hard. Like I would say that the healing side of coming out of trafficking has been incredibly difficult. This is, I could even say, the hardest part, because I don't have the option to escape my reality.
Yeah,
but it was a disaster after court. Obviously, I had reactivated that whole using. I would do anything I could to not fall asleep. It was, sleep was so danger. It interpreted so much danger to me. But law enforcement, the prosecuting attorneys, even my probation officer, everyone just understood, and they didn't charge me with additional charges. They were really, really trying to help me, but everyone was so limited in what they could do back then. We didn't have a trafficking survivor facility. In Medicaid facilities in Utah, I would likely have crossed paths with the people that, or affiliates of the people that I was trying to prosecute. There was no safe place. Right. And I didn't make it to trial.
Right.
I didn't make it. And they dropped the majority of those charges and he walked away. He did about 18 months in county jail waiting for this trial to take place, but obviously in a crime with a victim and you don't have the victim show up, there is no crime. So,
and this may not be something you could talk about. I mean, and I'll ask, and again, if you're not comfortable answering anything, please don't. Sure. This isn't a gotcha kind of a thing. I'm just curious because I know, you know, I know who our listeners are, and I know that we have a lot of moms and a lot of families with kids. And while there is a large law enforcement component, we do get lots of questions from our listeners all the time after an episode. And I think they're going to benefit so much from this. But in the situation you were in, there's so much to kind of chew on. And if you don't mind, I'd want to just interject and ask a couple things while they're on my mind. I don't have full Alzheimer's, but I have some timers. I sometimes forget things. So I'm going to try to avoid that the best I can today. So just to kind of chew on things, you were an adult, you were a young adult when you were kind of brought into this, and you sort of alluded, like, maybe family life growing up wasn't really traumatic, or there wasn't a lot of stuff that we see with a lot of people that are in this kind of situation. We see sort of fractured families. We see domestic violence. We see, you know, mental, emotional abuse. But you got yourself into a situation or a relationship, I guess, that started that pattern. Is that right?
And I had the history of the fractured family.
Okay.
History of trauma and drug use and assault. That absolutely happened to me at a very young age.
Okay.
But I did get myself into what I thought was a romantic relationship with a very questionable individual.
Sure.
And then that grooming process started.
Right. And that's so common. We see that a lot. We talk about that a lot because we see that in a lot of the, you know, obviously we work specifically child exploitation. And so for us, we're in agencies where we get to, you know, sort of formally specialize. And so we don't necessarily cross over to the adult side, though they are eternally linked, you know, because it typically, like you, has started from a young age and in the home or whatever. So that's a really common thing. So. And then where did it go from there, that relationship you started? You said the grooming process.
The grooming process, slowly pushing me. At that time, I was with my family and the healthy members of my family, and things were going well in my life. But slowly inching in. I would say most people would classify it as, you know, extreme violence, but at that time it wasn't. Violence started, and then substance abuse. And that was the tipping point. And even for my family, because I had had a history of substance abuse in the past and I had been sober and in recovery when I had met this individual, they interpreted it as she's using. And the message that family members of people that struggle with addiction is hold firm boundaries. Don't engage, don't be codependent, you know, all those things.
Sure.
And then I felt really alone. But anytime I would attempt to run away from him or go, you know, dry out at a family member's house to try to get away from the situation, their lives were threatened.
Right.
So it became, there were many times where I would run away and I ended up having to go back because people were too, and this is after my family stopped, right?
Okay.
People were too frightened to have me there because the intensity with my trafficker was, they understood how dangerous it was. And at some point you just kind of give up and just comply out of survival mode.
Yeah. Well, it speaks volumes too. I mean, you clearly care for your family. You love your family. You don't want to see your family in harm's way. And so to kind of put into perspective, you know, anybody would feel the same way. Like, I mean, if your family is being threatened with violence or worse, I mean, that's a very real thing. And that in itself is a trauma and a stress that, you know, causes all kinds of things. And being someone in your shoes who already had some issues with addiction, that's what's those internal feelings is what's going to drive you to what you think is a comfort zone, which is substance, you know, a substance abuse issue. And as you know, now I'm assuming, and from all appearances, like that just masks, you know, those things just mask the underlying problems. And so I, you know, again, I'm not thinking anybody's going to fault you for that. I know that society in general, just sort of, you know, even in today's environment, there's far more understanding, I think, of the problem. But, you know, back in that time frame, when you're talking about, I don't think society as a whole really sort of understood it. One, they didn't have any personal tie to it. I'm sure your family understood on some level, you know, even for what it was. But that drive to, like you said, just simply go along with things, you know, like you become numb to things for so long. So that's very brave of you.
Yeah, it definitely masked some things, but in my hindsight, it perpetuated that grooming process and pushing me out from society and my community and how things were perceived.
Yeah.
So, but it really was my saving grace in that time. I can't imagine doing it sober. That I don't know if I would have made it out.
Wow. Well, that, you know, again, that speaks volumes. How did, once that, or it's not a once, it's a, as that grooming behavior, you know, is pushed to you and pushed onto you, and, you know, the substance use is numbing things, I would assume, to some levels. Like, what do you know? Was there a defining, like, transition where it moved into a specific trafficking situation that you're comfortable talking about? Or
I think I had recognized it January 2011.
Okay.
But the trafficking had started before that. In my eyes, it was something that I had to do to survive, that he just happened to offer me a way to survive that he benefited off of. Right. But it was in the moment in which I stopped complying that the violence happened.
Okay.
And even just a couple of violent situations, I still wasn't, you know, registering that I had been like picked for this thing.
Right.
It wasn't until January 2011 when I was hospitalized that I understood that I didn't really have a choice, and I needed to find a way to survive in this lifestyle. And there were so many times to plotting my way out that never really transpired, that never took fruition, several times. And I had gotten away a few times, but he always had ended up finding me. And then it was dangerous for the people who were trying to help me.
Yeah.
And I, you know, just going back, and the violence became the easy part. It was,
gosh,
you get really used to that. And this, even the cycle with like,
you were saying about the violence and how accustomed you get to that.
Yeah. And even in just your textbook domestic violence situation, after the violence, there's a moment of where no violence had happened. And sometimes when you're, you know, beat up too bad, you're not marketable.
Yeah.
Right. So there were times where I would instigate those things just because I was tired. And I got used to what was happening, and I felt like I had a little bit of control over the trajectory of how things would go down. So, I mean, there's a time of the year that's coming up here in Utah, and it's called the Sundance Film Festival.
Okay.
And that is a high traffic time in Utah. Like, it is hell week.
Right.
But there are times where I could instigate violence before that, because nobody wants to, these wealthy elite individuals do not want to buy a beat up woman.
Right. Right.
So I got used to the game. And once I got over the fear of the violence, it felt a little bit more manageable.
Wow. That's that's a very interesting way that you would learn to kind of cope with that. I mean, you're dealing with so much stuff and so much pressure, and to realize that, oh, I can just get my ass beat and end up in the hospital and I won't have to go through this. Like, wow, that's incredible. That's incredible. I meant to ask, were you in this situation on your own, or were there other girls that were also involved?
Other girls
as well.
The terminology that is used is a Romeo pimp and a gorilla pimp. Right. And they usually work together in these things and have multiples of situations happening. Towards the end, I was really unruly.
Right.
And I was starting to present a problem. So I was a little bit more unmanageable, but I didn't, there were times, I would say maybe about a year of my trafficking on and off, that I was trafficked out of a spa, like a massage parlor.
Okay.
And at any given day, you probably had anywhere from 4 to 8 women there at a time.
Gotcha.
And the woman who was like running it, right? It's really deterring for any men to be around in those areas,
right,
for, you know, customers that are coming in. The woman who ran it, is the terminology, is a bottom bitch. So right, she's the one who's in charge. And more times than not, this is a survival mechanism for women. They get to a point where this is how they survive. And by recruiting other women in and controlling those women and, you know, making rules or, translating some of the rules. So, yeah. And that there were two different women that I had came around, but I was becoming very like, I had that renegade. Just, I was done. Yeah. I was done. The violence didn't scare me anymore. My family was so pushed out. The criminal justice system had their thumb on me. I just was becoming a liability.
Yeah.
And so things on the trafficking end kind of went more towards just regulars. I wasn't really being presented to like Sundance anymore or online anymore. It was just the regular customers that would come all the time.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was one of the questions I had, is that we typically, from our side in the law enforcement community, we see trafficking situations that involve the online component, like online mm-hmm. ads and things like that. So I'm assuming, since you mentioned it, that was something that was also pretty regular in your situation.
Yeah. Yes. That was a website, I'm sure you're aware of it, Backpage.
Yes.
And you would pay for ads with Bitcoin.
Right.
But yeah. And you know what, too, you know, my trafficker's demise, that's part of the reason why they were able to charge him and connect him to my trafficking, because there were ads and his phone number that was put on the ads, and he was sending messages through those phones to me. So there was a great trail, but it really opened up dangerous clientele.
Sure.
So, and yeah, it's what it felt like to me is, once I veered more into like really elite parties or these, you know, I would say you're more wealthier clients,
right,
the more dangerous they were. So I did everything I could to get out of that situation, because things were getting pretty dangerous in that arena.
Let's talk for a minute, if you can, and you can be as specific as you want or as general as you want. But I think it's important to highlight, you know, specifically you mentioned Sundance and what a breeding ground that is for trafficking, mm-hmm. and how that component is brought in. And we have mentioned here on our podcast before, you know, we have similar situations where these happen, and we see them in really common things like the Final Four, the Super Bowl, or, you know, the Stanley Cup, or anywhere there's a very large event. We mm-hmm. see spikes in this sort of situation, human trafficking. Let's talk about that a second, because I don't know that our average consumer of our podcasts, I mean, I'm sure they've heard of that, but mm-hmm. I don't know that they've ever heard it from a perspective of someone who was participating.
Yeah. The Super Bowl is the largest trafficking day of the year. I was trafficked every Super Bowl. It was horrific, to the point where I don't watch football anymore.
Right.
And anytime we have a big sporting event, the All-Star games or, you know, Super Bowl or any of these things, I'm actually on ops. So, you know, this is where I choose to be, but I don't participate in any of those things, draft week, any of those. I do know that anytime there's a large congregation of people who are interested in partying or having a great time, there's a large portion of that population that just want to have a good time and watch football. But it does bring in this element of a lot of money, a lot of drugs, a lot of booze, and a lot of women. And, you know, some people are perceiving, and it's still somewhat socially acceptable, is like, oh yeah, they're all going to go party and go to the strip club. Well, I would say it's safe to say that 50% of those women in there don't have a choice. Like, they would probably experience large amounts of violence if they said no.
Right.
It's just is what it is. And when you talk about these big, huge parties, it's seductive women that come into play. But then it's because, you know, you have these things happening, you have a lot of people who exploit, you know, these somewhat normal society norms of people having a good time. And then things get really dark, just because it's like like a group mind, the group think.
Yeah.
And things get, there's a dark arena in there.
Yeah. And you mentioned, you know, you don't watch those sort of things anymore, and that's completely understandable. But you mentioned that you're out on ops. And so one of the things we never do on our podcast is we never give away any sort of trade secret as to what we do. But I just want to clarify for our listeners, you know, what you mean by that. And so like I've participated in those as well, because we know the environment, we know the conditions, we know what's going to be coming in, and how you explained it is spot on for what happens. And I would even say, you said maybe half of those are there not by choice, and I would say it's probably a higher percentage than that. Realistically, yeah. People need to understand and put into concept that, or into context rather, that, you know, when there's a large event, and we'll just use the Super Bowl because it's probably one of the largest in the world, that there are people from all over the world that come to a location, usually a week in advance or longer, to gear up for one day, for one game. And so there's all of those components that you mentioned, and the dynamics of what takes place, and the dark and seedy side of what takes place with these victims. It needs to be known. People need to know that, because I think that gets lost in translation, you know, through all the Coca-Cola commercials or all the other commercials that come out, and the Super Bowl ads, which is going to be the most popular for the 30 seconds and the, you know, however many millions of dollars companies are spending for that purpose. That's not the kind of ad I think that we need to be running. I think we need to be running some proactive ads about, pay attention, look around you. Let's get things in perspective. I think society as a whole has dropped the ball on some aspects of that, but it's all a business. It's all a business. It's all about people making money, unfortunately. And it comes at the expense of a lot of women, unfortunately. So
yeah,
I'm glad that you mentioned that.
Yeah. I mean, you can sell cocaine one time. You can sell a human being 1,000 times.
Right.
I know that America and the world wants to do something about human trafficking. I just think that they don't know what to look for. When I talk to most people, they are under the impression that these women and children are being transported by semi, and they're in cages and things like that. And that is not the majority of what trafficking looks like. And I think if we started to kind of pin down some of that messaging accurately, and we're not looking at a Liam Neeson film, people would be able to help a little bit more. But I mean, ultimately, and talking to the parents that are listening here, it comes down to what's happening in your home. Like I said, when I first started, is I was the limping gazelle. I was an easy target, and that came from unresolved trauma, fractured families, and the grooming process. And that stuff takes time. If I would have been able to recognize, or someone would have been able to communicate to me, like, hey, here's this guy's history, here's all the charges he's had with other women, and, you know, all these different things, I've been more aware, I don't think I would have been in that situation. But I mean, I wasn't getting that information nor that feedback. And at that time, people weren't really relaying information like that this is a trafficker, as opposed to this is just a really dangerous gang member that likes to, you know, hurt women. And that's what he would have been described as then.
That's terrible. I mean, I'm glad that we have opened our eyes a little more, you know, from a prosecution standpoint and an investigative standpoint and all of those sort of things. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't do anything for what you went through back then. And that's very unfair and very unfortunate. So
it is. I mean, it did come to a point where I was determined to figure this thing out and to do the work and to get back into this conversation as a survivor at the table with law enforcement, advocates, attorneys, treatment centers, all of it, hospital, healthcare workers, that to start to describe and help people conceptualize what it is that we're actually dealing with in Utah specifically. And, you know, since then it's branched out to to doing some things, you know, nationwide and participating, helping with, you know, convictions and rescues and all these things. But I was absolutely determined because I don't know why I survived, and I get survivor's guilt all the time. Sure. And thinking about the women that were left behind, and I don't know why. I don't know, but I do know that I have a lot of passion and fire to help society figure some of this stuff out. And it has led to a beautiful life. It's led to a beautiful life. And, you know, there's a lot of hard times in the work that we do, but the wins are just, yeah. They fill your cup, and every life matters. You know, there's 2% of survivors that make it out and 1% that get a conviction. And I just don't want to misuse this time that I was given, because I feel like I don't deserve it, but I definitely don't want to misuse it. And we're trailblazing this, and right. we're waking up and education is happening, and healthcare workers are more aware of, you know, situations and conversations and what it takes to exit an adult. To rescue a child is much easier, because yeah. You can just go in and grab them. With adults, there's that word consent.
Yeah.
And that's where things get really, really difficult. But even that, it's all great to have a rescue. They're really glamorous and wonderful, and everyone loves that. But then what?
Right.
But then
we preach that a lot, you know, in our arena, which, you know, is specifically towards kids. But the crossover is there. It doesn't make any difference. Like we preach all the time, and we go all over the country to teach cops how to do this job, and not just do it, but to do it because it's a passion, because you're doing it for the right reasons. You're doing it the right way. And that's what's so important to us, and that we translate that, you know, we don't skirt the rules. We follow the rules, and we follow the rules for a reason, because one, we don't want to make it difficult for somebody else down the road. We don't want to develop bad case law. We don't want to do, you know, nobody wants their name read in front of the Supreme Court, you know, Godwin v. whatever. I don't want any part of that. And so it's paramount, you know, that we do this right, and we do it for the right reasons. And so educating people about that, and especially law enforcement, like that's where the rubber meets the road, because you have to change the paradigm of overcoming the way things were done before, because that's the way they were done. And having an open mind, you know, to seeing that, you know, no, not everybody's a shit bag. You know, not everybody's a dirt bag. Not just because you work vampire hours, and the majority of the people that you encounter during those times, you know, are probably have some sort of element to them. You have to humanize it. And I think we've made strides, you know, great mm-hmm. strides, but there's still a lot to be done, you know, a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. And, you know, it was a very long time that law enforcement and I were enemies. We were enemies. Yeah. We didn't like each other. We both clearly understood that. But it wasn't until I was seen by law enforcement and understood, and I didn't feel judged by them,
right.
that relationship changed dramatically. Dramatically. Right. And I don't blame some of the law enforcement officers in my past, because I was awful to them. Right. I was awful to them. And I thought that we were fighting two different wars, and I was just, but it, I never took the time for them to understand, for them to fully understand yeah. what I was going through, because it didn't feel safe. But I really, really see great things happening with some of these NGOs that are bridging some of these gaps for law enforcement.
Right.
Because they're tired. They're tired. They're overworked. It's just too much for even one department or one state to handle. This has to be a we thing. Like, we have to figure this out, because we're still trying to pin down aftercare for survivors of sexual violence. This is extremely difficult, and it costs a lot of money.
Yes, it does. Yeah. One of the, and we've, again, things that we have preached over and over on our podcast, but just to piggyback on something you said a few minutes ago, where, you know, yes, it's nice. It feels good to get a win, to make a rescue, to make an arrest or to file a case or get a guy in prison. Yes, those high five moments are addictive on some level to the law enforcement side. But for us, and what one of the things that we consistently preach when we go teach around the country is the high five moment, you can have it. Have the high five moment, fist bump, you know, pat each other on the back. But that's when your job really starts, because the aftercare, the follow-up, you know, doing your job and being diligent once you've spiked the ball, you have that spike the ball moment, how important it is for you to do that follow-up. And if you don't do that, if you're not trained that, oh, we got to do the fist bump and the spike the ball moment, now we're done. No, you're not. This is where you have the opportunity to turn someone into a long-term survivor forever, and then an advocate like your situation. And not only that, but you can uncover more victims. And the more you do, and the I'm telling you, I know from, you know, personal experience of working these, like when you look at it from that mindset, when you go into this with the understanding that, all right, yeah, we'll give us a pat on the back, but then we're going to dig in and we're going to really keep going. And when you see the fruits of your labor in the sense that you recover more victims and you get more people and more victims into a better, healthy situation, and you empower them to take their life back, like there's nothing better. From my perspective, there is nothing better than that. It's amazing. So, man. Yeah. So listen, we're kind of at our like chopping mark for what we normally are. You know, we don't want to overburden our listeners. So if you're okay with it and are willing to come back for another episode, is that cool?
I would love that.
Okay. So stay tuned, folks. We're going to kick back off, and Amber will be back with us for part two of this. Stand by.
Thank you for listening to the Catfish Cops podcast, brought to you by Brandon Poor and Tony Godwin. For additional information and available resources, please visit our website, www.catfishcops.com, and click on the resources link.